This podcast is sponsored by El Spelio at elspelio.com. I've got a link in the description of this podcast. El Spelio are importers of some of the finest caving lights in the entire world. And Doug will hook you up. You go to elspelio.com, you can see what they've got. Right now, you can get a rescue SAR, you can get a lunatic, you can get parts for a pre-existing El Spelio. If you're already in the El Spelio club, you know what I'm talking about. But if you have something on your light that needs to be replaced for whatever reason, caving, as you know, even if you don't have an El Spelio, can tear stuff up. You can order parts from elspelio.com. You can also get custom sewing done by elspelio.com. Pick up one of the greatest lights in the world or anything else that they offer there. And while you're there, and if you're doing that, make sure that if you're going to buy stuff and at checkout, you enter the promo code podcast. That'll save you $20 on any order over $300. Any order of regularly priced items over $300, you'll save $20 with the promo code podcast at elspelio.com. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Thank you so much for downloading this, playing this, listening, however you're hearing it. I appreciate it very, very much. If you are a caver, welcome. You know where you're at. If you're here for the first time, thanks for giving us a shot. If you are not a caver, as in you are not someone who has ever gone caving, as in gone into a wild cave with just the gear on your head and on your back, this is a good place to learn about it and learn from people who have been doing it for a long, long time, because that is the important thing in caving is do not go alone and make sure you go with people who know what they're doing for your first time so they can recommend what to bring. Maybe they can even loan you some stuff. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, quite the opposite if you do. And you should really get involved with organized caving in order to, you know, make friends who do it and get a group going together. So we have clubs, local chapters of the National Speleological Society called grottos, and you can find your grotto, the grotto nearest you, at the NSS website, caves.org. Pretty easy to remember, caves.org. Mark Wenner is this month's guest. Mark and I had a great conversation at the end of last year. And as you'll hear, he's just a terrific communicator. I barely had to do any editing on his episode. It's always nice when that happens, but I'm okay with it if I got to go scissor hands on it. But with him, I absolutely didn't. We'll get to Mark in a little bit. I wanted to tell you about a presentation being organized by the NSS, Virtual Topics in Cave Rescue, on February 10th. There's going to be the first Zoom presentation on virtual topics in cave rescue. Once you register for one of these, you're registered for all of the sessions. These will go from February through May. They've got over 25 speakers for this whole series, booked for this whole series. And of course, they're going to record them and put them up on the NSS YouTube channel as well. So if you can't be there live, you'll be able to at least see it later. But on February the 10th, they're going to do the first one from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. And it's going to be on all kinds of stuff, patient perspectives. There's one a presentation called What I Learned Spending 14 Hours Peeing in My Wetsuit. So you'll get to know what people go through if they've got to be rescued. Rescue pre-planning and operations, patient management, hazardous atmospheres, rescuer care, all kinds of stuff. Again, virtual topics in cave rescue. Register for those Zoom presentations. I've got the link to register in the description of this podcast. Click that and you'll be off to the races. Oh, what's been going on with me? I started my new job and my new schedule on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Morning radio. I'm a morning radio host now in Indianapolis on WTTS. Just a good station with good music for good people, and you can listen anywhere, just like any radio station. So if you got a smart speaker, you can say, Alexa, play WTTS. And from 6 to 10 Eastern, I'm your guy. And since it is the most listened to day part, or the most critical day part, I guess, they're running these promos, these getting to know you promos throughout the day. And I talk about caving in one of them, which is bananas to hear. And I'll get emails from friends, caver friends who are going, are you talking about caving on the radio? What are you doing? But anyway, it's been cool. The schedule is absolutely brutal, though. I have to go to bed by 9 and be up before 5. And so it's definitely been an adjustment. And getting this episode edited to be out on time, as opposed to the episode that I opened up the year with, which was not out on time, it was a challenge. It was a challenge. But I'm here for it. All right, so Mark Wenner, let's do it. Mark is a cave diver. He's also, in his professional life, he designs and builds and treats recording studios. And that, we nerded out about that for like 20 minutes before we actually started talking about caving. I didn't include any of that in the podcast. Maybe I should have. I don't know. I'm sure you just want to hear the caving part. But that was really, really cool. And thank you, Mark, for your advice and your insight on all that. Anyway, Mark's got some great stuff to share. Here's me and Mark Wenner. How often do you go to convention?
Well, I'm not big on traveling. If it's local, I'm there.
Yeah.
So Huntsville in 2004, man, I was down on that. And the Cookeville one, I was there. My caving projects have me just busting. And you really got to prioritize. Am I going to do business? And that's part of the balancing act with this whole thing, is how do I balance what's left of my career, my passions. I have more than one. So, you know, caving came in and just went chomp and took such a dramatic piece of my life. And I never saw it coming.
It's a lot of people's stories, I feel like.
Well, that's the beauty of it, though. You know, I spent 40 years playing music and then I spent 40 years building recording studios, and now I've spent 20 years caving. And I thought about it today. It's kind of like it really gave my life 3D. I had two things going on, and if I went out of this life fulfilling those two things with the people that I've worked with and things that I've accomplished, that would have been plenty. Any other person would go, man, that's great. But when the caving world came into my life, Bill Steele said this to me one time too. He says, when it sticks, it just stuck, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I went down that road, and the things that have happened since then, no, this is where I was supposed to be. Ultimately, that's where I was supposed to be. I still don't know why, but it's obvious to me that I'm playing a role within that that's beyond me.
So diving started in the 70s for you. When did caving start?
Well, the diving was right out of the gate in 72. That was the first certification. And then caving, really, I started cave diving first. So
really?
Let's say 92 or 93, right in there, I was starting to get trained for cave diving down in Florida. And I wasn't even full cave certified when somebody that I'm diving with to this day, Marbury Harden, who's a local tag guy and really good at what he does, he called me up and he said, hey, I just see that you're getting trained for cave diving and I got a cave trip coming up. Would you like to do it? Well, I didn't have a helmet. I didn't have a suit. I wasn't a caver. And so, you know, like somebody that should be doing it differently, I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. What do I bring? And he said, I'll bring a 3 mil wetsuit. It's like 3 mil wetsuit for, you know, 7 hours swimming up and back to a sump that's 2 miles upstream. It was crazy. And that was my first trip. And guys that have know Windy River up in Fall Creek Falls go, so your first cave trip was Windy River? And I go, yes. And the people that were on that trip were just outstanding cavers. About 26 of them. We had two teams, and one half went up to the upstream section and one half went to the downstream section. So we had two sets of divers, two sets of diving gear, and there you are swimming in a river. Well, that was the most common thing in the world for me, to be transporting tanks, because I had already done the California diving in kelp beds. And, you know, that was the easiest thing for me, was to grab a tank and float down a river. But underground and getting to the sump, now that was that feeling of being in the bowels of this place and going, holy smoke, I'm totally over my head right now.
I don't know. Have you ever gotten to an objective?
I've talked to guys who have done cave diving before on the podcast who have gotten to the objective. You know, they've got the whole crew together, and then the conditions are just bad. But you do it anyway because you're there.
Well, it happened 2 weeks ago. I mean, and we've really seen a dry spell, and this is the point in time when we really start to look at the possibility of getting in the water again, really to do some groundbreaking stuff. But I'd say that chances of conditions, well, you know, we look at weather models. We, you know, it's not like we're not looking at the logistics and trying to get our timing right, but chances of it being not right are fit at least 50% of the time.
Yeah,
you know, there's many, many things that can happen, but, you know, if I looked at how many times we've succeeded, it's probably 95% of the time. And zero visibility to a sump diver. I'm not talking cave diver anymore. I'm talking about sump diver. What we did 2 weeks ago, it was you couldn't see at all. And we were running line in Virgin Cave, and Marbury was out in front of me, and I had the book, so I was going to survey it, and I just didn't care. I just kept my – let's put it this way. There's dives where your hands are off the line most of the time, and then when it gets a little questionable, your hand is – and eyeballs are on that line. You don't want to get lost. And this was the dive where your hand never came off the line. You know, and that's the only way. And I had no idea where Marbury was. He was out in front, and I just kept running. I kept getting azimuth. There's no way I could see the sidewalls, so there were no L ruds to any of that. I was just getting distance, counting knots and azimuth, and then putting it in the book and moving on. And all of a sudden, boom, I'm out on the old line, the original line. I'm like, what just happened? You know, we took a complete circle, but I was like, did I just fold back on the line, turn around accidentally, because weird things have happened. That's happened to me before. And I finally realized I was on the old line because it was a different color. It was an old line. And the arrow pointed out. And I thought, well, where's Marbury? So now you're in there kind of by yourself and you're going, I really don't know where I am. I guess I'm on the line. I'll go out. And then I went, well, I better put an arrow on it so he knows that I'm out, because I didn't know that he was still in there.
Hmm.
And so there's a lot of breadcrumb involved in what we do, intuition, maybe some luck. But we came out, and he's looking at me, and I go, what? And he goes, really? Like, what was that? And I said, that was terrible. It looked crystal clear when we went in. And he said, man, that was terrible. So, yeah, it happens all the time. The long stuff where you're really packing 20 people in there and putting stuff in the water, again, it happens all the time that conditions aren't that good. And the visibility is the last thing standing in our way, really.
I tend to put, because I've never done it before and possibly never will, I tend to put cave divers sort of on this pedestal, and I sort of mythologize them in my mind, and I think, oh, they're all cool as a cucumber. They've got resting heart rates way down. You know, they're like astronauts almost. Mm. I don't know, how fair is that assessment?
Well, I've seen that reaction. You know, the grotto. Emily Davis in Nashville Grotto said to me one time, she said, there's people in this grotto that look at you like, and I can't remember the word that she said, but, and I'm always shocked. I'm like, well, and I just to pull back from that statement, what everybody else has to realize is a diver, especially by the time you get to be a cave diver, that is totally our comfort zone.
Yeah.
We are way more comfortable. I'm totally comfortable in tight passage, in no visibility, just sitting there, just listening to the bubbles roll off the ceiling. And people don't understand. They'd look at it like you're out of your mind. And I've listened to my heart rate just go, don't, 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 because you're in that beta state or wherever we go, zeta probably. But, you know, that's the thing is, and it's hard to explain. Forrest Wilson, who's my sump diving mentor for decades now, said, hey, it's not the dive that kills us, it's the drive. You know? Yeah. And the way he drove, that was truth, but that is truth. I feel much more comfortable, you know, diving than I do driving down the freeway. That's a certainty.
I guess you have to, don't you?
Yeah, pretty much.
How often do you, I almost said, how often do you do it? But what I kind of want to ask is, how often do you have to do it? How often do you feel like you need to get underground and in the suit?
Well, I've never, you know, broken it down to, oh, every week I feel this way. I mean, I went caving Sunday and it had been a good long while. Yeah. Well, I mean, I dove 3 weeks ago in a blue hole out in Putnam County. And that was like, oh, did that feel good? Even though the conditions were bad. And you got to factor in, you know, these are friends. And so when I get to see a friend and he gets to dive, and we have that enthusiasm and it's Virgin Passage. I mean, nothing could be better than that. And but then 3 weeks went by, and then I got a call from one of the guys up in Roppel Cave, because Kevin Downs has been working on the Dalio entrance to the SCCI Dalio entrance. And they're putting a huge drain in there, and they needed hands on board. And he was like, do you want to come up and do it? And naturally, I was like, oh, I love Roppel. I love, you know, Pat lives down the road. Pat Cambises lives down the road. So I stopped and had breakfast with her. And I pull up, and I mean, it's obvious. And I knew a lot of the people on the cave team. So it was just like a homecoming. But all the COVID stuff comes into play.
Yeah.
And this was a serious project. I mean, this was serious engineering. We were putting these huge culverts in, bringing them through the cave entrance, and there was a 35-foot pit that had been, you know, excavated, and we were putting these culverts down and doing a dig down on the base level of the cave. So just getting to the objective, the bottom base level of the cave, was serious caving. I mean, it was slot canyon, popcorn, and you were going, you know, horizontally through this crawling through this, you know, this canyon, slot canyon, and it was tough caving, but I was like, well, this is cool, you know. And then we got in there and we dug with hose for 4 hours, moving like 2 to 3 inch cobble that had fallen out of this dome where they were going to put this culvert. And, you know, I left my pack, my pig was, I didn't have any idea what we were getting into. So there I am with no food, no water. And, you know, after about 3 hours of digging and digging and digging, serious digging, I said, I'm going to feel so bad tomorrow. My arms are going to be killing me tomorrow. Hey, could you pass down my bag? So after 4 hours of that, we crawled out of there. Then it was 40 bags of concrete on a dolly and the culverts coming in. I mean, we were there 12 hours. Nobody even thought about dinner. Nobody thought about any. It was the most intense thing that I'd ever seen. I mean, the guy handling explosives. I mean, we were throwing some major rock around, and you know, Dick Market, he's a legendary guy up in Mammoth. All really specialized, passionate guys. I learned more in those 12 hours than ever. But it was the hardest trip. I think one of the hardest trips I've ever done.
You dove in Mammoth, and people hadn't done that in a while when you did that?
It's crazy how the national park system works, and I get it. You know, they're worried sick. There's more than one national park. There's many, and the dive coordinator for the national park system handles the whole U.S. seaboard. You know, Pearl Harbor. We're talking about projects that are beyond what we can imagine. So when some guy down in the Bahamas, I don't even know where this dive coordinator is, but he's on an island somewhere. And when he hears about sump divers going into Mammoth, he knows it's dry suits. He knows it's low visibility. He knows it's caving to get there. That to them that's a whole nother set of logistics. Mm. And so, you know, and I'm not going to say many deaths, but there were deaths attributed to diving, technical diving in national parks over my 10, 15 years of being involved with the national park. This is nothing new that they'll just stand down. They'll give you a permit. Getting a permit is everything. So, you know, 2012, we had a permit to go into Roaring River, which is a fantastic base level cave that it's basically the bottom level of Mammoth, the lowest point in Mammoth. And we found a blue hole on a recon trip in the bottom of that stream bed, and we couldn't even believe it. It was 40 feet deep. That means it's 40 foot deeper than any place in Mammoth. And it all the water for Roaring River was originating out of that blue hole. So we had a permit, and we were going to go in there and do some scientific stuff with species counts. And there's reasons that the National Park gets us in there, and then there's reasons for us to be in there exploring. They try to marry those two scenarios. And boom, before, you know, we had bad weather the day that we were supposed to go in there, and we never saw that permit again.
Huh.
And so from 2012 to Echo River, which was 2017, I couldn't even get close to getting a permit. And then there was a regime change. Barclay Trimble's the new superintendent up in Mammoth, and super cool guy, believes in exploration, and they had gotten two ROVs, you know, remotely operated vehicles, stuck in Echo River, just where it pours into Green River. So it's the springhead for Echo River. And they wanted those ROVs out of there. Mercy Academy had lost them, and they were stuck in there. They were stuck in the old dive line from 26 years ago. So I got the call, and it was Rick Toomey, who's head of the science department up there. Rick Olson and Rick Toomey had that up really well. And boy, that was our opportunity. They gave us approval. Complete anonymity. We're signing a lot of waivers, and you know, we're not employees. We're not paid to do it. So they just formed their little liability waiver system. We have evac plans for evacuation. We have all the right stuff because we've done it over and over and over. And that was it. That was history. That was making history because it hadn't been done in 26 years. And then that's an opportunity. When people find out about it, it's like, man, you were diving a national park like Mammoth. And then the opportunities start to come a little easier. But it's still a dynamic that's hard to explain to anybody. I mean, the weather models, just for example, the weather. Last year was the second wettest season on record. So we have all of 2019 being the second wettest season. The first 6 months of this year was the wettest period in history, recorded history. Mm. So we've had a year and a half of solid weather that totally contradicts being in there diving at all. Or any place else in Tennessee. Or, you know, these storm fronts, they stretch from Minnesota to the Gulf of Mexico. So it's staggering. And then what? I'm listening to the news tonight, and it's the worst hurricane season on record. So we're up against something right now that you said, how often? I'd be diving every day. If I lived in the Yucatan, I'd be in there every day.
Yeah.
And being a diver up here, everybody goes, well, come on, let's dive. The dive team drives me nuts. They're just like, come on, let's dive. I get calls from all of them. There's six of us, you know, and nobody lives here. And I go, it's not the right time. We just dove 3 weeks ago and we couldn't even see the line. And so it's, I guess it makes it interesting if that's your kind of fun, but, you know, dry caving. So then I dry cave as much as possible just to keep that end of the spectrum going. Cause it is kind of a two-pronged fork. You know, you got to be good at getting the stuff there, and you got to be good at doing what it is when you're in the water. How often do you have to do it to be proficient at it? Oh, that's like, you have to be doing it all the time. I mean, I know that I don't dive enough. I know I don't cave enough. and it shows.
It's a fitness thing. It's like it's strange to compare it to ballet, but you hear it from ballet dancers. If you stop doing it for even a little while, it's not going to get any easier.
Yep. It's everything. It's how tight the straps are on your backpack to what's in your backpack. I've seen guys in front of me that cave all the time. And you know how a cave suit sounds when it brushes against the wall. And I'm like squeaking and squawking and I'm turning sideways, but the guy in front of me, I don't hear one thing. Just slipping through the cave. So yeah, you know, the guys that do it all the time, it's amazing, but my chops come back fast. You know, I felt really good this weekend, really good. I've been exercising a lot for the last couple of years, and it makes a world of difference when it comes to upper body strength and the way you use your wind, you know?
Yeah. You're the senior diver officer for the National Park Service. Well, for Mammoth, I guess, and
right,
Cave Research
Mammoth.
Foundation.
Yeah. I'm definitely senior because I'm older, but, I live outside of Nashville, I'm down in Franklin. And the dive team, they do trust me. I mean, I'm pretty level-headed and a straight shooter, and I don't really pull punches. So, when we start to do a lot of reconnaissance stuff, they said, well, Mark, you're right there. Why don't you just drive up? And I was building my relationship with Pat Cambyses all along. And why don't you just go up and do the reconnaissance for the Roaring River trip? And then it started. You know, they the research in National Park, the research people, they are used to seeing my face. They're used to seeing me come in the door and talk about logistics first and talk about the personalities that we can bring in. So my role was just kind of a natural. It's nothing that I had planned. And I think a lot of it has to do with my proximity. And I probably had my own agenda. I mean, in the back of my mind, I'm going, if we could accomplish diving Mammoth, it could position safe cave diving in so many places in the world. And all we have to do is get published with a bit of it. And that's when all of the publishing started, just writing a lot of articles and, doing a lot of presentations for the karst resource agencies. And I don't know, just like it was a ball that was starting to roll down the hill. And I think it's really ended up in a good place, a good, powerful place where other people are hearing about it and they're going, wow, they're really doing good work,
Mm-hmm. I got to talk with Chrissy Richards about Snail Shell mm-hmm. Cave.
Yeah.
And you've done some stuff in Snail Shell Cave.
Yeah, I've just about done all of it.
Yeah.
And it was with Marbury's the one. Marbury Harden said, let's go in. I've got a sump upstream. And Forrest Wilson was down in Atlanta actively diving, was all about it. Let me see. Brian Williams, who has done so much connection. Brian Williams actually put the tanks on and broke that sump. And he's on our dive team up in Roppel, too. So these are all people that I met in one day. Windy River, I met all those guys in one day. And that from that stemmed through everything that we're doing today. Those same personalities are involved. We went 5,000 feet beyond the sump in Snail Shell. And then Jason and Chrissy got involved. And Jason and Chrissy are quintessential cavers and divers.
Yeah.
So the last time we were all in there, Brian Williams, me, Chrissy, and Jason was 2008. And we were so far upstream. Jason and Chrissy were wearing heated vests underneath their dry suits. Brian and I were not. Those guys know what we're up against. And we were in there. I didn't feel my feet for a week after that particular trip. Literally.
Oh, my word.
So, yeah, it was exciting. I was just in there with Ray Maslach like four weeks ago, and they were like, how did you guys get all your tanks and all your stuff to the sump? And we're like halfway to the sump. We hadn't even started over the breakdown piles and up over the waterfalls or any of that tough stuff. I'm just talking about floating in the river. We were in inner tubes, just kind of la-di-da-di-da. And how did you guys get your tanks up here? And I go, well, we strapped them on and we swam. And all these four guys looked at me like, and one of them's a cave diver friend of mine, Ray Clark. And he goes, you swam to here with two tanks on a harness? And I go, yeah. And in a dry suit, right? And I go, no, wetsuits. We used to do it in wetsuits. And he just looked like horrified. And I said, then you got to get through all this breakdown and up. There's a waterfall up there. Then you get up to the sump and you suit up and you dive that and you go another 4,000 feet.
Oh my
well,
God.
How long? And he says, and you what, you stay overnight? And I go, no, then we pack our gear and we do it all again. And we come out of there like 16 hours later.
So the total trip time is,
oh man,
what are you looking at, like 18, 20 hours, something like that?
No, it wasn't never that bad, but it depended how far you went upstream.
Ah.
And what we got accomplished, a lot of times some of the survey work was kind of loose. You know, we were just trying to plot a line so we could get a line plot. Chrissy and Jason, if they're involved, it's a grade 5 survey, period. Yeah. Yeah. End of story. It's going to be a map. And Jason released an incredible map on Snail Shell after all was said and done, and we felt that we pushed it as far as we could. But yeah, it's been a good 14 years of that. That place is at least a decade of pushing it, along with other things. We were working anything we could in tag. So it's kind of like the heyday. You know, you got to be the right age. I was 50 probably when all that was happening. I felt like I could chew nails and spit them out. you know, so you got to be young enough and strong enough and driven enough and have the right people around you that have all those same, what does Derek say, the skill set. You all have to have that skill set, and you have four or five people that want to penetrate that sump and go do that and get that work done. Nothing better. Nothing better. But if you try to revisit that 15 years later, you're 15 years older. The people that you're working with just don't have it either. Hmm. So, you know, the younger guys that are coming up, they are on to new passage, new springs, new this, new that. But, you know, these bigger caves, like what happened with the National Grotto 50 years ago, those guys are into big drops and big virgin passage, and they pushed Gerald Mooney and Ed Yarborough and those guys. They were pushing everything. And then, you know, that was their heyday. They were 25 years old. They were doing 400, 500 foot drops, you know?
Yeah.
So you got to do it while you can. And I guess that's the moral of the story on that one.
You did Letch too.
I did.
Have you only done it once?
I've done it once, and you know, Pat, I went out to dinner with her one night. She says, you want to do Letch? And I looked over the table and I was like, what's Letch? She says, just Google it. And then she calls me a week later and says, well, what do you think? And I said, I'm on. So, you know, it was just, it's one of those, you rarely get an invitation.
Yeah.
And if you do get an invitation, you have to do it. And because me and Johanna was with us.
Yeah, you had a great crew.
Yeah, it was Jennifer Fute. Adam Haddock is a great cave photographer, cave diver, explorer. Mm-hmm. And he had never done it, and I had never done it. And here we are with four women, and they're... I go, Johanna, how many times have you been in here? And she goes, like 13 times. I think Jennifer said 13 times. And I was like, 13 times? And everybody knew that we were the virgins, right?
Yeah.
And, but man alive, I remember, you know, it was beautiful. It was 6 days down. We went 1,000 feet deep to the Big Sky campground. It's like being in a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And six solid days of survey and 12 hours a day. And, you know, 68 degrees, so you're in shorts, and the gypsum and is like snow. So you're laying in the snow. You can make snow angels, but they'd kill you because National Park is so, that is so roped off and so taped, and every dried up bat is, everything is marked and inventoried. And we were strictly there to resurvey and resurvey. Pat had actually done all of that. She was one of the original, on the original team to do all of that area. But we crawled out of there, and it was just me and Pat that crawled out together because we were the oldest and probably the most tired. And I looked at her and I said, if you said, let's go back in right now, I would do it.
Wow, really?
Yep. That was one of the most phenomenal things I've ever seen. One guy at Natural Grotto said, because I did a presentation when I got back, and he said, well, did you, like, is there a lot of rope work? And I looked at him and I said, you don't really ever get off rope. I was kidding, but you definitely are never out of your harness. So for, you know, it's probably 6 hours to camp. And, you know, it's just a lot of traversing and a lot of Boulder Falls is the only drop, 140 feet. But the ropes are, you know, 10 to 12 mil. Some, you know, everything's already in the cave, so it's terribly muddy. You have to know exactly what kind of descender. You have to have done it to not get really in an unsafe situation. I was frozen on rope right from the start. I had the wrong rack for what we were doing, and it had aluminum bars on it, and I just didn't know, you know. I'm used to a Petzl Simple. I've done 200, 250-foot drops with it. It would have been perfectly fine to C-rig. In fact, Adam was jumping around with a Petzl Simple. He just C-rig it, and whew, he was down the rope. But you have to have done that before and have somebody run you through the process, or you're the guy doing it for the first time. Mm. I'm sure there's some people out there laughing about this right now. I'm saying it because they've been there.
Yeah, but I talk to anybody who's been in Letch that I get to talk to. I've got to talk to them about it because I'm never going to get to go. I've just got to and people who listen, you know, we all do Letch vicariously. So I got to hear all the Letch stories, you know.
Well, I don't know. Don't give up on it. I mean,
I'm fine with never getting to go. I would just hold the crew back. I don't know. Maybe not. But one of these days, I'd like to just do the entrance, just to say I've been in it.
Oh yeah, I mean it's phenomenal. I mean it's all stainless steel. Just for example, we open the door. It's like this steel door on this cage.
Yeah,
and it's all stainless steel culvert as you start to descend down into the actual where you're walking passage.
Yeah.
And that cave, you can imagine 130 miles, that there was so much wind coming through that particular door. And I remember somebody opened it, and I went through it, and it was just sitting there. And that thing slammed so hard that it sounded worse than a shotgun. And, you know, it was like a real wake-up call. If anybody would have had their hand in it.
Yeah.
That's how this trip starts. From the very minute you get in there, you go, this is big. The cave's big. There's some powerful things going on in here. And every maneuver you make, like I found out real quick in Letch, that if you lead with your right foot the whole trip, you're going to have a knot in your gluteus maximus that you're never going to get out. Meaning you have to plan every move you're making, or you're making the wrong move too many times.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So on the way out, with the way in, it's one set of dynamics. You know, you're really going over some rough terrain, but you're kind of so energized that you don't even perceive that you're moving through that difficult passage. And on the way out, it's all uphill. And then you realize how difficult what you did to go in. You know how going down a hill is harder on your knees than going up?
Absolutely.
So that's the case with going in there. You're just like trying to overpower the sensation of all these obstacles. Go, 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 go. Keep it together. Keep mindful, mindful. You just keep repeating it over and over. And then on the way out, you're going, I don't remember any of this. So that's how extreme some parts of it are. You block it out of your mind like amnesia. And then on the way out, you go, oh, wow, what an experience this is.
I'm not a survey caver. I'm not a project caver. And so I don't have this feeling of discovery that I chase. You know, I just like to go caving. I'm sure that if I did it, I would enjoy it and would want to keep doing it and whatnot. But luckily I haven't taken that drug yet. But is there a moment in that part of your caving life that you chase? Is there a feeling that you got that you kind of chase, like, yeah, I want to feel that way again?
Well, you know, I kind of akin it to, you know, if you look for an arrowhead, you know, a point, an Indian point, you never find them, right?
Right.
It just seems like on my property is loaded with Indian artifacts. Because it was a beautiful lake, and it's a watershed down to the Harpeth River, and the Indians love this place. It's been like this for thousands and thousands of years. So I, you know, the first time I found one, I wasn't looking for it, and then as I started to look for them, you could never find them. So that's the attitude that I take with caving. I mean, I was given a presentation one time, and somebody raised their hand and said, "Have you ever been any place that nobody's ever been?" And I thought about it for a second just to build up the dynamic in the room. And I said, every time we go caving, we're someplace that somebody's never been.
Right.
And the whole grotto just went. There was a gravity to it because it was really true. As a diver, you know, chances of that are really high that you're constantly going to be laying line. And the possibility of popping up in dry passage is a high possibility. And the first time, 2007, we went into Rapel, I was the low guy on the food chain. I mean, I barely made it in there as a diver. And then the guys that were there were, I was already diving with them and snail showing all of that. So they're like, oh, Mark Winter, yeah, bring him along, man. It's our team. I got in there and, you know, I was really just getting my chops. As a dry caver, I still didn't have the stuff that I needed. And I patched together the dive, and the three of us got back there, and we're crawling up in Swicegood Avenue. Roberta Swicegood found this slot, kind of a bedding plant, a little slot with a mud crawl up to this. And then there were 56 stations in there. It was a beautiful borehole. It's a bunch of rimstone dams. You get back into like the 50, 60 station, and it's like the most beautiful place you've ever been. So meanwhile, those guys are kind of pushing. We're pushing all the leads that were on our map that said, push this, push this, push this. Because you only have so much time on the other side of a sump. Your resources are running out, and you just don't have a lot of time to mess around. And I crawled down this little hole. I mean, it was nothing but chert. Sharp chert, and I was in a wetsuit, and we were 13 hours into the trip, and I was just by myself, and I just went, nobody would want to go down that rabbit hole, but I'm small, you know, I'm 130 pounds, wet in the shower, and I crawled in there, and boom, I'm in a beautiful pit with going passage down at the bottom of this 30-foot drop. And so I start crawling out because I didn't have anything. I didn't have a rope. I didn't have anything. So I crawl back out, and I run right face-to-face into Brian Williams. And he goes, because it teed before it got out into the Swicegood Passage. He said, "You find anything?" And I said, "Yeah," like that. Right? And I didn't even know the significance of it. You know, I didn't know what that feeling was. But Brian looked at me like, you know, I can't say it on the air right now, but he wasn't, he was like, well, good for you. But he was like, but why not me? You know, I could just see it in his face. And so, you know, we put our harnesses on and we, you know, got our book out and tied it into the passage. And it was like one more thing. And I remember coming out that night and Jill Heinerth, super cave woman diver, was there doing photography and diving with us. And I remember the cameras were rolling because she's always documenting everything. She said, did you find something? And I was like, hell yeah. So it is. It's a phenomenal thing, whether we pursue it, thinking, well, that's the reason I'm a caver. Well, yeah, I'm sure that that's the case. But it's just it's a sequence of events, you know. And when it happens, I mean, to be on a connection like connecting Mammoth to Roppel or some of the big stuff that Jason Richards has done, it's just phenomenal amounts of work and investment. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
What is this International Year of Caves and Cars 2021?
Well, NSS, I've just got the kind of the spec sheet on it maybe 5 months ago. I think Pat Kimbises is on the committee to start to put the concepting together for it. And basically, it's an international recognition of cave systems. And I just read through the paperwork today, but I just briefed through it real quickly because, you know what, it's going to be 2021 here in a matter of months. And, you know, COVID and everything going virtual is going to radically change. This might be the wrong time for it. But it really is about having an international collaboration with cavers throughout the world and research people. And, you know, for me and Pat, it has been, well, we know a venue that we could do a nice symposium in. So we already kind of figured out what that could look like and what the platform we had been we'd been remapping Big Room and Big Mouth Cave. And then I found a Virgin Cave underneath the floor of that cavern's performance room. I was asked to dive it, and I got in there by luck, total luck, and it turned into beautiful borehole passage. So here you go again. It's total luck. You realize the significance of it. It's base level cave because there was a river running through it. So it's like nobody's ever been here, and it's a swallet. So it takes quite a lot of water and brings all this cobble down into the swallet and covers the entrance up. So nobody had ever been able to even see the opening. And I didn't know any of this. Once the swallow gathers enough water and the underground swells, that aquifer system down there swells, then it turns into a spring and it blows all the cobbles out. So this is an area that we thought this would make perfect presentation material because it's such a beautiful cave. It's got a big performance room for music and you can host a lot of nice public events. It's got everything.
Yeah.
So I think everybody, all the grottos, this is an NSS deal, and all the grottos, I think, are aware that this was projected to be something that could bring the world together, the World Caving Organization and the resource people, and just as an instructional platform for caving.
I hope COVID doesn't disrupt it too much, because that I think that that's needed right now, just a conversation about it. I do think collaboration exists in a very real and significant way in the caving world, but anything to bring cavers together even more.
Well, our last NSS convention, that proved that we can do quite a lot virtually.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think we're all getting tuned into the fact I don't know anybody that's not Zooming. And, you know, I've never met you, but here we are meeting virtually. Yeah. And you're out there cutting a good path with your shows in that you started something that was needed a long time ago. And now it's even more needed. And there you go. I think that, this is going to go on for a while and, the resolve doesn't look any closer. So I just think that that's the path we're going to have to take right now. Nashville Grotto has done an incredible job. The executive committee has done an incredible job of keeping the Grotto together. I talked with Holly Mackinlock from the Louisville Grotto Sunday, and she said, man, we're not doing virtual. We need to keep the Grotto alive, and it can't be done virtually. So there's a lot of different ways to look at how to skin this cat right now, and there's some desperate measures being taken, and I'm not sure, you know, I can't weigh in too heavily one way or the other. I mean, I'm very conservative because I'm older and I feel like I've got to watch what I do. But people are going to have to make their own decisions, and they better be smart about it.
You chaired the Nashville Grotto at the same time that I chaired the Central Indiana Grotto, same term, 2017 to 2019. What did you do as a leader? I mean, I've only been caving since 2010, so I haven't been doing it that long. They just needed somebody to do it, and I said, you know what, I'll do it. You've been caving a lot longer. Was there anything that you implemented when you became part of the leadership?
Well, first of all, kudos to you. I mean, I don't think it's a matter of how long or how experienced you are. I mean, passion is everything. Passion drives everything. And for me, the vice chair was at our Roppel exploration. And he said, man, you'd make a really great chairman. And I had my hands full, and I just kind of was resistant to it. But I was voted in, and I realized at the first executive meeting how much seemed to be missing. And probably the reason that I saw all of that is because of the education I had gotten up at Cave Research Foundation. I mean, Jim Borden, who's been keeping track of all the data for Mammoth and Roppel, all of that is in his computer. And these guys have models. Roger Brucker, I mean, these are phenomenal organized people in the caving community, and they've been, you know, the Cave Research Foundation is 50 years old. So basically, and I've always said it publicly, especially in front of the Grotto, I said, if you think that I know everything about exploration or about the process or what a grotto really is, I don't. But I'm telling you now that these are the stepping stones that we need to take. And so the first PowerPoint for me was, do we have a website? Do we have a repository for trip reports? Do we, and I went down the list. And it was like, we need all of these things nailed. And I lived with that bullet point of about 7 items for 2 years. And I'm not a good delegator, that I know. So I was just expecting these magical people to say, yes, I'll handle, you know, I'll be the webmaster and I'll do this and I'll do that. You gotta fly, get a fly swatter and beat them into submission in the corner and go, you're doing this.
Yeah.
But, that's how I approached it. I approached it from, I sat with my mouth open the first meeting. Listen, do we have this? And they go, no. Do we have that? Do we have all of our data anywhere right now? Did we take the speleology, the chronicles, any of that stuff? And everything was no. And I go, we have to have all of those bases covered. Let's go. Let's do it. And we started to get this velocity. I think everybody saw that this is a firm direction. So that's all I can say that I felt that I brought in. I'm relatively organized. I did a PowerPoint for every Grotto meeting, so things that were old business went off the list and the new business was on the list, and all of that stuff is in a PowerPoint. So all the pictures on Facebook, all the news, everything that was happening was encapsulated in a PowerPoint presentation. Now I can easily take a thumb drive and just handing a 30 gig drive to my vice chair and said, keep this someplace. Because we still don't have a repository for this data. And so that's how we seem. And then as that directional thing, and I got, it was really into luminary speakers. I'd get Ed Yarborough to come out. I said, let's do a luminary talk. And he'd bring in Buddy Lane and Chuck Mangelsdorf, these guys that were doing all the serious stuff back, 40 years ago. Gerald Mooney will not get in front of an audience, no matter how hard you twist his arm. But these are guys that really did groundbreaking stuff, and they're sitting at a table, and the room was packed to the roof with people, and the electricity in the room. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't even have to say boo, And so then we started looking at, well, what would be really good speakers? And so, see, each one of, so I knew that at the end of the day, which was 2 years for me, 2 years, I had some things happen that I just needed to focus on them. I felt terrible about it. And I, Carolyn Strand took over, and she's an incredible executive and very organized. So, but each one of those things that I feel that I brought to the table and set in motion are implemented now. I mean, you should see the trip reports and the grotto trips that they've got weekly. And these were not my ideas. These were the way a caving organization needs to run. And you hand it off. You hand that baton off to the next person. It continues to grow. NSS is, I see something happening with NSS that I've been waiting for about 20 years. The velocity is coming into their newsletter, and the new board of directors must be the right players. Everything's starting to mesh, and that's what it takes. And we need that. You need that through all the grottos, because we're all, satellites of the mothership.
When you passed the torch to Carolyn?
Yep.
I mean, I've seen her name before, and so was it tough to convince her?
No, she knew exactly what she wanted to do, and she's done it, and to do it within the temperature the society's at right now with everything virtual.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of young cavers coming in, a lot of people that really wanted to cave. It needed more organizational skill, more Excel spreadsheets and keeping track of schedules. And that's not my forte. So no, she was watching. She was coming in for 2 years consistently. And she always said to me, I'd like to take on this, this, and this. So I knew that she was already into the website building and kind of a wizard in that department. I should have said absolutely. And pretty soon she was making the executive meetings. That was a natural transition. I just hated to see things turn out the way they are right now. But they've managed online. The meetings are up on Zoom. You participated in that one. That was as valuable of resource as anyone in person. So, it can happen.
Well, the reason I ask, it sounds like you got lucky with Carolyn, but there are so many grottos, who just keep cycling through. I've talked to people. They just keep cycling through the same three or four chair people. It's just like, I haven't done it in a while. You do it. Nobody else wants to do it. Well, I haven't been secretary in a while. I'll do it, I guess. That kind of thing. I don't know. Were you able to light a fire under any of the younger people to get more interest in grotto leadership or participation?
No, there's key people that have been there all along that have been there much longer than I have and are way more dedicated to the grotto over a long term. Mm. But there's personalities back there that know the law. Hatch knows the grotto really well. He's never been chairman before, but he'd make a great chairman. So, no, I think when you've got fresh people coming into the grotto and there's always some leaders in there, that you just have to find out who those personalities are. And like anything else, everybody has a role. You just have to be, if you're chairman, I would think that you would be able to determine who those people are, and be sensitive to the fact that maybe they're going to bring in some nice magic to it. But in areas that there's not a lot going on with the grotto, they don't, we're in Cumberland Plateau. I mean, caving is heaven.
Yeah.
So there we have all this opportunity, and we have all these talented cavers also, involved Chuck Sutherland and Pat Cambyses joined the grotto while I was there and was doing survey classes. So imagine we've got these resources that make it pretty exciting if you're able to be in a meeting. And I would want to be, that's why I wanted to be involved in that. I was really, it was just an extension from what I was already public speaking and I'd already been published and things like that. So it was just the next kind of chain for me. But I really enjoyed it while I was there.
What's still on your list as far as exploration? Let's come back to exploration. Is there anything that you still want to do or any place you want to return to really bad?
Well, I think some of the projects that we start, we have to end. So I'm really super excited about the diving objectives of Mammoth. Mm. I mean, it's virgin territory. And, you know, if there's anything that I do, if somebody said, you're not going to be able to do this next year, I would want to finish out the stuff in Mammoth. And I'm not talking about being the sole diver on that stuff. I'm talking about bringing the best divers that I've ever worked with, Matt Vinzant down in Florida with Karst Underwater Research. He's a consummate rebreather diver. And so, you know, he's the kind of guy that I would want to involve. Mike Young from Kiss Rebreathers, another one. Those two work really well as a pair. So, yeah, I'd say to answer your question that finish some of these things in Mammoth and really tie some of this stuff that's not tied in. Get that done. There's always springs popping up. I mean, I get calls, random calls. Last year, August, I got called. Somebody had dug from the dive shop. The dive shop calls me and says, hey, this guy called us. He's a geotech engineer. And they just bulldozed the top off of Underground River over in Murfreesboro. And I was like, and I saw a picture of it and I couldn't believe it. So, you know, there's just these, I get these kind of off the wall calls. Well, and then we've got the right tools, you know, underwater radio systems, underground underwater radio systems. So we can pinpoint our, you know, our overlays, get our USGS overlays and pinpoint where we are underground. That's pretty useful. It's a great tool to have if you're trying to map terrain underground. We're writing an article right now for the NSS News, which we've never have. I've written articles for many publications, but Pat said, why don't we do an NSS News article? And it hasn't been done, and we've been pushing this cave for a long time. Let's do that. So, those are my bullet points right now. Just picking up on the remaining Mammoth stuff, diving some of the leads. Marbury's the only one here, but I know Chrissy and Jason are moving back into town. And whenever they come back into town, because they're in Hawaii right now, and I believe they're going to be living in Chattanooga, when they come back to town and the phone rings, it's a beautiful thing that they've got wherever they're going. So you just kind of go with the flow. I did one of the last things with them before they left town, and it was just amazing.
The thing about the NSS News article, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I feel like there are a lot of projects that need to be written about, but people hesitate to do it because, yeah, it's work to sit down and write, but it's also like, well, we're not done yet. So many of them, you're not going to be done. Especially when you're talking about something like Mammoth. I'm glad that you're doing that you decided to write an article, because you're never going to feel like you're done there.
No, 450 miles or whatever it is, it just keeps going and going and going. And we have written articles. We've written numerous articles for numerous publications. So, you know, there's the working components, is that now we've got a nice map and we've got all the radio location work done. And I did a presentation for the 2020 NSS Convention for U.S. Exploration, and it was well received, and that was that's the foundation of an article. So, you know, it's kind of like an automatic. Why don't we just finish writing this history, and this is where it's leaving off. And that's simple. I don't feel like, you know, we shouldn't write it because we're at the end of the line. There is no end of the line in Mammoth.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people have gotten excited about that. We continue to get more and more the support grows and grows. I mean, I'm sitting there making pancakes for 25 people, and you go, this is really working. This is something, you know, really working. And I got to give it to Bill Steele. I mean, I use him as a model, and he knows it. You know, he's been in the audience when we're debriefing and telling the cavers where we need support and when we need stuff picked up. And he's just smiling, his eyes glowing out there, you know, like, yeah, these guys got it going on. So it's we're all part of the same family, you know, and we all have projects going, and that's the beauty of it. I just feel really the community is let. I was received just like it was a very fluid moment in my life when everybody just let me in. Oh, you're a cave diver. Why don't you come down to Florida and dive with us? And it just started. And, you know, I think that's the key for what we've done on these expeditions. We bring in all these new cavers, and they get to see a real living operation, you know, the real deal. And they're drinking it up. And they've got an exciting story to tell after that.
I'm curious, because I've talked to people about working with media, working with TV, working with film, whatever it is. When you worked with Discovery Channel, what was that like? Because I've heard mixed things about working with that kind of crew.
Yeah, that was I took a bite off of that one, and I saw it coming. You know, I've been watching Josh Gates for years. He's just such an exciting guy. If I wasn't a caver, I would sit in my armchair with a cold beer and go, yeah, man, you know, I just thought he was electrifying. And my wife would go, man, you could do that if you could ever do something like that. So she was kind of drilling it into my subconscious. And I think it was last August, the phone rings and his producer, story producer.
Wow.
And she goes, this is Kate, and I'm from Expeditions Unknown and Exploration Unknown. And we're getting ready to do a show on Mammoth. And, you know, that I perked up real quick. And, you know, I know everybody there. So it's like, well, doing Mammoth, it's National Park. You're going to have to get permits. So, I do what I do with the studio building business. I just point a direction. Call Pat Cambyses, call Jim Borden, and call Rick Toomey. And I thought that she'd just go away. I thought I'd never hear from her again. And the next day, I heard from Pat, from Rick, and from Jim Borden, and they said, oh, I got a call from the TV show, and they want to do this, this, and this. And it was like a steamroller rolling down the street. And it was getting velocity so fast. And I was so dead center in the middle of it, I couldn't escape it. Jim's going, I'll fly into town, but I don't, you know, it's going to be $1,000 day, and I don't think they, blah, blah, blah. Hey, Mark, you got it covered. So there again, they defer to me to kind of coordinate, and it's what I do. So it's like, well, I guess I can coordinate it, but a TV show, a full, you know, 15 production people. Now, I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles in the film industry, and, you know, I was building recording studios, but I had a lot of people that were actors and this and that. So I spent some time in production studios, but man, this was like, we have the main scout coming October 1st. And it was like 3 days from now. And I said, he's going to be searching for caves so we can put this together. You can't bring 15 people, cameras and all of that into any part of Mammoth without it looking like you're on his, you know, walking passage that's been walked down by 50,000 people. And they had an agenda and they had a very discreet storyboard, which employed some paranormal stuff. They said, have you ever had any paranormal experiences? And of course I have. I've had numerous with the dive team there witnessing it. And I could go on and on about that. But the easiest thing in the world for me was to say, yes, absolutely. I've had, I've had that and more.
Okay, can well, you? Well, now I got to hear an example, though.
Well, we were coming out of Mammoth in 2015, out of Rappel. We dove all day long and climbed. We surveyed everything we could, packed our stuff, and now we were coming back through the passage. And it was me, Matt Vinzant, Brian Williams, and Mike Young. And, you know, it's wee hours, you know, 3 a.m, whatever. But, you know, we were used to doing those kind of days. And it wasn't the cave talking. You know, we weren't so blistering tired that we didn't have our senses. And I felt this presence behind me. It was like somebody on the left side of me walked over to the right side. It was as real as another person. And it didn't freak me out. I just went, man, there's somebody walking right next to me. And Matt, who was on the other end of the chain, said, I feel it. And we just kept walking down the passage, right? And then we got a little bit further, and it's the same thing. I could just feel it. It was a caver. It was a caver spirit. And I could tell you about how many divers have dove Rappel and proceeded to have diving fatalities, not in Rappel, but, you know, Ron Simmons was one of them who died down in Florida. So anyway, it felt very familiar. It felt like somebody that had been in there many times before, and that was just like us, just cave divers that was pushing that passage, and it felt like they wanted to walk with us for a while. And so that happened twice, and you know what? I just dismissed it, you know. But I was with Pat Kambisis one day at the field house, Hamilton Valley Field House, and we were sitting with Roger McClure, which is one of the guys that built the whole cave research network there. And she said, Mark, why don't you tell Roger about your experience? And I was like, what? You know, like, I didn't even want to really talk about it. And I told him, and he just sat there for a second. He goes, oh, yeah, that happens all the time.
Floyd sneaks up on you.
Yeah, you know. But then if I told you the other four times, then it gets a little bit more, what is going on here? So they that's what they want for a TV audience. So sure. I had, to answer your intended questions, it was the most intimidating thing I've ever done. I was terribly reluctant. I was very worried about the caving community looking at me like, what's Mark doing? You know, even the dive team was like, what? They're coming to do what? You know, and can I be involved? But, long. You think caving for 20 hours is a long day?
Oh, my gosh.
These guys are, you know.
Yeah.
They're absolutely crazy. And here's the clinchers. There was no storyboard. I never got any paperwork. I didn't even know, you know, I knew that I had to put a team of cavers together. So I put Pat Kambisis and Elizabeth Winkler, all people that I caved with, and Holly was on. So there were four of us, and we were going to be the caving team. And I was sure that they were going to call on the story about the paranormal stuff. But, man, I was front and center on the whole show, and I didn't see it coming. And Pat just said, you know what, we are exciting cavers, young cavers throughout the world. That's the only way you can look at this. If we were shooting a documentary right now, they'd be going, go back to that point, walk in here, say this. She said, it being a documentary versus a reality TV show or whatever you want to call this, it's no different. Things are staged. But, you know, I proceeded not to mention anything on Facebook. I completely put it under the radar everywhere. I really didn't do anything about it. Then I got a chance to meet Josh. He came into town to do a show at Ryman Theater, Ryman Auditorium. And it was the coolest thing in the world. He was just, because he is the consummate explorer, man. His energy is so... He's like us on 10. And he's going, man, I would love to go caving with you in Mammoth. And I'm like, yes, anytime you want to come in, let's do it. And then, you know, then I got a call to do another show. And this time it was going to be with Josh. And it was like, this is kind of cool. I'm sitting at the same desk as I am right now with you on a Skype phone call with Josh. And all being televised. And I'm going, this is pretty much like unlike anything I ever thought that would ever happen to me. You know, and then I got a call again for another show. They were doing a show on a cave in East Tennessee. And man, I purposely said, absolutely not.
it becomes a waterfall after a while.
Oh man. You know, I gave him some good direction. We turned him on to some good cavers in East Tennessee. And I think Clinton Elmore went out there and helped him.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things. You got to really watch what you, what do they say? You got to pick your battles wisely. But it was a great, great, great experience. The co-hosts were incredible. Everybody comes to the table with all kinds of experiences. They're not just actors. They're like leading expeditions in Brazil. And, oh, so you just do this. This is kind of like your side thing. And they're full-blown actors, you know, doing television. But, yeah, you know, it was, it's just one more thing on the docket. I don't know. It's a pretty weird one. But I'm smiling.
You know, there's a lot we could talk about. Is there anything you wanted to make sure we're left with?
Well, you know, I know that probably said a lot of things that I wish I hadn't. But, no, this has been wonderful speaking with you. I just think that everybody's got a role. I think a lot of it has to do with resources for cavers. I think everybody in the caving community is well aware of all that we've been through with White Nose, all that we've been through with protecting caves, all that we're going through with SCCI, you know, really being a guardian angel with our resources. Working with Tennessee Wildlife has been a dream come true. You know, there's zoologists and geologists and hydrologists. There's so many places that cavers can put their feet and get firm footing in the caving community. And I think that whether you're experienced or inexperienced, you just got to dive in there and take it where it leads you. I didn't plan any of this in my life, and it's been a wonderful experience. Ended up in Passage I never thought I'd ever see. So that's what I'd like to leave everyone that wants to start.
Mark, this was a pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for giving me the platform, and I look forward to meeting you in real.
Let's do it.
Okay, man.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark. Good stuff. And as soon as this is all over, I'm taking you up on an invite to Roppel. I'm serious. Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the sponsors of this podcast, Elspelio. Go to elspelio.com. Save $20 on any order of regularly priced items over $300 with the promo code podcast. Get a light, get some custom sewing done, get some parts for your pre-existing Elspelio that may have gotten beaten up a little bit from the rigors of caving at elspelio.com. Link in the description. And support the past sponsors of this podcast as well. Swago, get you a Swago pack for all that wet caving you're doing. If you're a cave diver like Mark or a wannabe, you gotta get used to that. So you gotta get a Swago. Organic Robot Designs as well. Hit up the Etsy shop, or if you happen to be in Greenfield, Indiana, stop by his storefront. Charlie, our new chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, owns a great small business in Greenfield, Indiana, Organic Robot Designs, that he built from his Etsy shop and from his skill set as a graphic designer and as a screen printer. And he is just one of the greatest daggone people on the planet. Organic Robot Designs on Etsy or the storefront. Let's see, next month, we're going to begin our series with California cavers ahead of this year's convention in Weed, California. I don't have names just yet, but March will be the beginning of that series, and we'll do that through June, maybe even going past June into July, August, who knows? I'm kind of doing this month to month at this point, so we'll figure that out. Anyway, thanks for listening. Until next time, kill nothing but time.